this is William Thank of Christigenia.org, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, November 7th, 2025. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present part 49 of our commentary on Isaiah, and this is titled, The Light of the Nations. Discussing the last six chapters of Isaiah, from the middle of chapter 43, Babylon and its fall to the Persians, as well as the related issue of the Persian policy which had paved the way for the rebuilding of Jerusalem, is the significant theme throughout all of them, all six chapters or so. The fall of ancient Babylon is certainly the central event in the near vision fulfillment of this prophecy, since Cyrus, the then future king of Persia, was explicitly named and his role in its fall was described. But as we have also explained, those events did not fulfill all of the descriptions found concerning the fall of Babylon in these prophecies of Isaiah. Therefore, as we had further explained, it is evident that these prophecies of Isaiah have a greater purpose than the end of the relatively short-lived Neo-Babylonian Empire. And for that, much of the language concerning Babylon here is repeated in reference to the fall of the entity, which is called Mystery Babylon in the revelation of Yahshua Christ. So in that manner, Babylon becomes more than the name of the ancient city, as it is often used as an allegory representing the captivity of Israel, as well as the series of world empires which would rule over the children of Israel in the time of their punishment, a time which would last for many centuries. For that reason, at a time when the children of Judah were in captivity in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had a dream where he had seen a fearsome vision of a beast made of four different metals. So the prophet Daniel had described that interpreted that vision for Nebuchadnezzar, where we read in part, and this is from Daniel chapter 2, this is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Daniel had already described the dream. From verse 36, I'm reading, and now 37, Thou, O King of Kings, thou, O King, art a King of Kings. For the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven has he given into thine hand, and has made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold, the first of those four metals. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all of these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. While the history of those four kingdoms, which are quite readily seen to have been fulfilled in the empires of Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, had only spanned a portion of the time of the seven times punishment of Israel, forewarned for their disobedience in Leviticus chapter 26. It was nevertheless a significant portion of those seven times. And before the fall of the fourth kingdom, which was Rome, Yahshua Christ, in his revelation, picks up where Daniel had left off, and his prophecies describe a period which spans a much greater amount of time, a time which is not yet complete unto this day, because Mystery Babylon has not yet fallen. Christians should indeed pray that Mystery Babylon is about to fall. We may interpret the seven times or years of the madness of Nebuchadnezzar, which is prophesied in Daniel chapter 4, to be indicative of the longer period presented in the Revelation. Where we read in part, this is the interpretation, O King. This is of another vision which Nebuchadnezzar had had. This is the interpretation, O King, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as an oxen. And they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Perhaps in that instance, Nebuchadnezzar, in his seven-year period of madness, is a type for all of the world leaders who throughout history have imagined that they could rule over men in a manner which is contrary to God. And for that, they certainly are as mad as Nebuchadnezzar had been. Now as we enter into Isaiah chapter 49, there is another break in the prophetic narrative as the context changes once again. From Isaiah chapter 41 to the final verses of chapter 44, Yahweh had addressed Israel in captivity in the isles and coastlands of the west. But then in the opening verse of chapter 45, Yahweh had begun to address Cyrus, although Cyrus was not yet born. Then in chapter 47, the word of Yahweh had addressed Babylon. And in chapter 48, it had turned to address the remnant of Judah. Of course, all of these prophecies are also relevant to all of Israel, even if all of Israel is not a direct subject of them all, because they are all integral to Yahweh's overall plan of salvation for Israel. So now, as Isaiah chapter 49 commences, the word of Yahweh is once again addressing Israel in captivity in the isles, the people who are described as being afar off. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from afar. Yahweh has called me from the womb. From the bowels of my mother he has made mention of my name. And he has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand has he hid me. And he made me a polished shaft. In his quiver has he hid me. And he said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. Here it is Israel who is being portrayed as the speaker, ostensibly in the person of Jacob himself, as these words are attributed to him. So Israel is portrayed as describing things which Yahweh had told him. Therefore, Yahweh is addressing the children of Israel afar off in captivity through the mouth of Jacob Israel himself. Even if Israel had not experienced these things personally, he experienced them as they had been fulfilled in his descendants. In the time of their captivity, as most of Israel had been taken captive to Assyria, and in the wake of the fall of Assyria, and several centuries of migrations into Europe and Central Asia, Israel had become hidden in the hand of Yahweh. And there are two references to that situation here in the language of verse 2. In the shadow of his hand has he hid me, and in his quiver has he hid me. that is evocative of the line in Jeremiah chapter 50, where the children, I believe it's 50, where the children of Israel are told, "Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war." Yahweh here has hidden Israel in his quiver, which is used to carry weapons of war, or at least arrows. This leads to a short digression. Looking for Israel in captivity, modern scholars always make the silly, insipid mistake of looking for Jews. They then claim that Israel simply disappeared because they cannot find Jews. But Jews are not Israelites, and the Israelites who were sent into captivity were punished in that manner because they were worshiping Baal. They were pagans, and they had departed from the laws and traditions reflected in the writings of Moses. So we would expect Israelites in captivity to have been pagans, as we are informed by the historical books of Scripture. I found something this week, and this isn't in my notes, but I thought it was really interesting, and I believe I had posted it on my X account, which is formerly known as Twitter. There was a, in Jeremiah, which is real close to the time when Jerusalem is destroyed and the remnant of Judah, those that weren't taken by the Assyrians, had been taken into Babylon. And later in the Persian period, some of those people that were in Babylon were enlisted to guard the island of Elephantine, which was the southern border of Egypt, as Egypt was held by the Persians and the Ethiopians and Nubians to the south had previously held it, and they were hostile to the Persians and wanted it back. So these people of Judah were being employed at Elephantine to watch the southern border and to guard it. So that's where something called the Elephantine papyri, which were actually letters from those people of Judah to the Persians, at least part of them, and they also contained other records such as contracts and things like that. Well, in Jeremiah, we read that the children of Judah were worshiping the Queen of Heaven, and the Canaanite goddess, if I have to use the term, the Canaanite female idol, Anat or Anath, was considered the queen of heaven in the religion of the Canaanites, and she was considered the consort of Baal. But the people in Judah were worshiping the queen of heaven, Anat, and this is in Scripture, and it's in Jeremiah especially, in a few different chapters, and they considered Anath to be the consort of Yahweh instead of Baal. And in the Elephantine papyri, we see this in Jeremiah, and in these papyri, we see the same thing, which verifies Jeremiah. We see references to Anath Yahweh, which is the queen of heaven and the god of Judah, combined together into a couple, if you will, and worshipped in that manner, or revered in those letters in that manner. So these people were basically that they were on their way to paganism. They were no longer keeping the religion of Moses. And that's just one example concerning Judah that was readily at hand. The children of Israel that went into captivity were worshiping the golden calf since the time of the divided kingdom and Jeroboam I, and that's over 200 years period that they worshiped the golden calves and Baal, who was also presented as a bull in many idol replicas. So Baal is a bull, they're worshiping golden calves, they're worshiping Baal, and they go into captivity doing that and not worshiping Yahweh or keeping the laws of Moses. We can't look for Jews in captivity, speaking of the captivities of the Israelites. It's just ridiculous that scholars dismiss the fact that the Israelites survived on the basis that they can't find Jews in archaeology. It's incredulous. It really is. So, now as we proceed with Isaiah chapter 49, Israel is portrayed as having answered the things which he had been told by Yahweh. So we read, "Then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for naught, and in vain, yet surely my judgment is with Yahweh, and my work with my God." So Jacob is portrayed as having confessed that he had lived for naught, ostensibly because the Israelite kingdom is no more, and the people are scattered across the face of the earth in their earlier migrations, as well as their post-deportation wanderings. Yet, in spite of the circumstances, Israel is also portrayed as having attested that my judgment is with Yahweh and my work with my God. The Dead Sea Scrolls Bible translates that last clause to say, "Yet my cause is with the Lord," that's the term they use, "and my reward is with my God." And they are also valid interpretations of the same Hebrew verbs. So now Israel is depicted as having been answered by God. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 5. "And now, saith Yahweh that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him." And we're going to discuss this seeming confusion because it's Jacob speaking. "Though Israel be not gathered, yet I shall be glorious in the eyes of Yahweh, and my God shall be my strength." The words, "though Israel be not gathered," are a further verification that it is the children of Israel who had been scattered in captivity who are being, I should say, who are the subject here. So even if Israel is still scattered, and I could say who are being addressed here, as they were in the opening verse, so even if Israel is still scattered and afar off in captivity, Jacob is portrayed as having made the declaration that he shall be glorified in the eyes of Yahweh, and in Yahweh his God shall he have strength, since he is apparently both the speaker and the subject, the indirect subject of what is being spoken, his descendants are the subject. This is a promise of reconciliation and restoration, which is continued in the verses which follow. So we shall read verse 6. "And he said, it is a light thing," and there are problems with this translation, or perhaps with the underlying text that we shall discuss. "And he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the nations, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth." Here both the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible and the New American Standard Bible read this passage very much like it appears in the King James Version, but with some minor differences. So we shall read this verse from the later of those versions, from the New American Standard Bible. "He says, is it too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel? I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." Because it is Israel who is being addressed, it seems that the word of Yahweh is implying that it is a light thing or a small thing. I'm sorry. That Israel shall raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the preserved ones of Israel, which is the way the text of verses 5 and 6 appear in nearly all of the English sources which we consult for comparison, which is the reason why we read that second version here. The primary reason why. However, the Septuagint, as Brenton had translated it, and the Douay-Rheims translation of the Vulgate each have a few differences in verse 6, which are worthy of note. In the Vulgate, the first clause of the verse reads, "And he said, it is a small thing," agreeing with the Masoretic text, "that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to convert the dregs of Israel." This seems to be a fair translation of the Latin text, and that word for dregs is actually the word feces, which is pretty repugnant sounding in the ears of most denominational Christians today, I'm sure. And while it is certainly not inappropriate in regard to the condition of Israel at the time, it is possible that Jerome was working with a variant Hebrew text when he translated Isaiah, as there are also variations in the verbs here in this verse among the manuscripts of the Masoretic text. In the Septuagint, the first clause of the verse reads, "And he said to me, it is a great thing for thee to be called my servant, to establish the tribes of Jacob and to recover the dispersion of Israel." So it has a great thing rather than too small a thing, and it has the dispersion rather than the preserved ones of Israel. Although either term properly describes the same people, the Israelites dispersed in captivity were the Israelites who were preserved out of the destruction of the ancient kingdom in Palestine. Then more significantly, the final clause of verse 6 in Brenton's translation reads, "Behold, I have given thee for the covenant of a race, for the light of the nations, that thou shouldest be for salvation to the end of the earth." That rendering is an adequate representation of the original Greek, where Brenton properly translated a singular form of the Greek word genos as race. So the nations which would receive the covenant and the light were nations of the same race, according to the Septuagint. But the phrase, "for the covenant of a race," does not appear in the versions of Isaiah presented in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible or in the Hexapla of Origen. However, the Septuagint is the oldest of all of the surviving witnesses to the text, so it really cannot be summarily dismissed. In any event, the meaning of the passage is nevertheless rather enigmatic, since here Yahweh God refers to himself as the Redeemer of Israel, and yet his word is portraying Israel as if Israel is going to recover and provide salvation for himself. There was a similar circumstance earlier in Isaiah, for which we shall read from chapter 41, verse 8. "But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham my friend." Then we'll skip over a few chapters to Isaiah chapter 44, verses 1 and 2. "Yet now hear, O Jacob my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. Thus saith Yahweh that made thee, and that formed thee from the womb." Very similar language than to what we have here in Isaiah chapter 49. "Who will help thee? Fear not, O Jacob my servant, and thou, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen." Then, in the intervening chapters, in chapter 42, we read, "I, Yahweh, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thine hand, and will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the nations, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. For I am Yahweh, that is my name. My glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images." Yet here there are several prophecies which could have only been fulfilled in Christ. The only way by which this may be reconciled is in the fact that Christ himself, as well as the apostles who brought the light of the gospel, of his gospel, to the nations, were all of Israel, And in that manner, Yahweh saved Israel through the seed of Israel himself. So these prophecies forebode the fact that the Messiah of Israel would come from among the people of Israel. Then, from another perspective, Christ is also Yahweh God incarnate, and in that manner, Yahweh is the Redeemer of Israel, as he had asserted here and throughout Isaiah. And he did not give his glory to another, nor his praise to graven images. Now we have also the light for the nations in Isaiah chapter 42 and here in chapter 49. Much later in Isaiah, there is a similar prophecy which spans the dividing point of chapters 59 and 60. I really can't read chapter 60, verses 1 and 2, without reading chapter 59, verses 19 through 21. And that's the way Judeo-Christians read their Bible. They always start at the beginning of a chapter, but there's always context before the beginning or after the end of a chapter, which helps explain those verses on the border of the chapter. So this similar prophecy in Isaiah spans the dividing point of chapters 59 and 60 and encompasses the same circumstances in which Israel is described here, but apparently at a much later time. Verse 59, chapter 59, verse 19. So shall they fear the name of Yahweh from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun, which is the east, when the enemy shall come in like a flood. Now the enemies, by this point, have already taken Israel into captivity. So this isn't speaking about the Assyrian captivities. And most of Judah is also gone. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of Yahweh shall lift up a standard against him. And that didn't happen when Jerusalem was taken, because Yahweh had already declared that Jerusalem would be taken into captivity. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them return from transgression in Jacob, saith Yahweh. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith Yahweh, my spirit that is upon thee, and my words which I have put in thy mouth shall not depart out of thy mouth, nor out of the mouth of thy seed, nor out of the mouth of thy seed's seed, saith Yahweh, from henceforth and forever. And of course, that never happened in the old captivities of Israel. Yet this is speaking of a time when the enemy shall come in like a flood. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the nations shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. We esteem this passage to refer to a much later time, because it seems to parallel the prophecy of Revelation chapter 20 concerning the camp of the saints. And I will leave that there until we get to our commentary on Isaiah chapter 59. The earlier of these prophecies, and this passage in chapter 49 in particular, are alluded to or cited in the New Testament in Luke chapter 2, and in Acts chapters 13 and 26. So in Luke chapter 2, there is an elderly man named Simeon, who was promised that he would not die until he had seen the Christ, the anointed prince or Lord. And when Simeon is introduced to the Christ child in the temple in Jerusalem, he makes a request indicating that the promise was then fulfilled, where he is recorded as having said, "Now release your servant, master, in peace according to your word, because mine eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in front of all the people, a light for the revelation of the nations and honor of your people Israel." And that light for the revelation of the nations is a very important phrase that the King James Version completely mistranslates. It takes a word which literally means revelation, which is the word apokalypsis in Greek, which is the word that we get our title Apocalypse from, which is the revelation of Yahshua Christ. They take that word and they translate it as lighten, a light to lighten the nations. And what they did there is basically criminal. It's not a light to lighten the Gentiles. It's a light for the revelation of the nations and honor of your people, Israel. And that's an extremely literal translation. Later, in Acts chapter 9, after Paul of Tarsus has his experience on the road to Damascus, Christ had appeared in a vision to a man named Hananias, who was enlisted to help Paul. And after Hananias had seen a vision informing him of this, we read, "And Hananias replied, 'Prince, I have heard from many concerning this man, how much evil he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And thus he has authority from the high priests to bind all of those being called by your name.' But the prince," referring to Christ, "the prince said to him, 'Go, for he is a vessel chosen by me, who is to bear my name before both the king, the nations and kings of the sons of Israel. For I shall indicate to him how much it is necessary for him to suffer on behalf of my name.'" And if I remember it, and I should, I hope I remember it when I post the notes to this program tonight, I will actually post a short conversation I had with one of the AI chatbots, I think it's ChatGPT, in which I forced it to admit that the Christogenean New Testament translation of Acts chapter 9, verse 15 is correct, where it says that Paul is a vessel chosen by me to bear my name before both the nations and kings of the sons of Israel. And if you compare that to the King James Version, you'll find that it's quite different, and I would say that their translation is corrupt. Then even later, speaking to certain Judeans in Pisidian Antioch, a town in western Anatolia, on the borders of the ancient lands of Pisidia and Phrygia to its north. It's not the Antioch from Acts chapters 13, 14, or 15 in there. It's a different Antioch, for much further west, on the border of the land which by Paul's time had been known as Galatia. And Paul had interpreted his mission in part, that mission given to him as it was announced to Hananias in Acts chapter 9. He interpreted it in part where we read in Acts chapter 13, I believe, verse 46. "Then Paul and Barnabas, speaking openly, said, 'To you it was necessary to speak the word of Yahweh first. Since you have rejected him and judge yourselves not worthy of eternal life, behold, we turn to the people. For thusly the prince commanded us, I have placed you for a light of the nations, for you to be salvation unto the end of the earth.' While Yahshua Christ is the light come into the world, as it was portrayed by both John the Baptist and by himself, as it is recorded in the Gospel of John. In those words, Paul the Apostle portrayed himself and the other apostles as being the bearers of that light, as the light to the nations, since they had brought the Gospel of Christ to the nations of scattered Israel, which is the promise and prophecy that is found here in Isaiah. Then, even later, in Acts chapter 22, Paul once again interpreted his commission of Acts chapter 9 as he had addressed the men of Jerusalem upon his having been arrested in the temple on false charges. And he said to them in part, and I said, Prince, they know that I was imprisoning and flaying those believing in you throughout the assembly halls. And when they spilled the blood of Stephanus, your witness, Stephen the martyr, even I myself was standing by and consenting and keeping the garments of those slaying him. And he said, go, because I shall send you off to distant nations. At that point in his address to the people of Jerusalem, they had cut him off and responded with threats to kill him. However, those distant nations to which Paul had been sent are one and the same as the nations described in the opening verse of this chapter, where we read, listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from afar, that Yahweh has called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother, he has made mention of my name. That first verse also evokes the ministry of Paul of Tarsus, who had attested in Galatians chapter 1, in part, that it pleased Yahweh, who selected me from my mother's womb, and called me through his favor, to reveal his son by me, that I announce him among the nations. Where once again we see that both Christ and his apostles are the fulfillment of these words in Isaiah, where Jacob is portrayed as being instrumental in his own salvation, ostensibly through these of his own descendants. Paul must have known that he and the other apostles were indeed the fulfillment of this prophecy. This prophecy of Isaiah is cited one further time in Acts chapter 26. There, where Paul had been falsely accused, and he had already appealed to Caesar, by which he avoided standing trial before the hostile Judeans, Herod Agrippa II had nevertheless wanted to hear his case. So while on account of his having already made an appeal, any hearing of his defense was inconsequential, Agrippa wanted to hear him anyway. And the Roman procurator, Porcius Festus, complied. Porcius Festus, a name that means happy pig, complied. Therefore, Paul also complied, and at the end of his address, he had said in part, however, obtaining assistance from God, unto this day I have stood bearing testimony to both the small and the great, saying nothing outside of the things, and this is important, saying nothing outside of the things which both the prophets and Moses said are going to happen, whether the Christ was to suffer, whether first from a resurrection from the dead is a light going to be declared to both the people and to the nations. And at that point, Paul was interrupted by Festus. However, in his words, we see that Paul's profession was asserted to have been consistent with the writings of both Moses and the prophets. Here in the prophets, we see that the people who were to be brought the light of Christ are the scattered children of Israel. In Genesis chapter 35, the patriarch Jacob was promised that his seed would become many nations, where we read in part, and God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. Earlier in that same speech before Herod Agrippa II, Paul had described which nations he spoke of in another way, where he said earlier in that 26th chapter of Acts, and now for the hope of the promise having been made by God to our fathers, I stand being judged, for which our 12 tribes, serving in earnest day and night, hope to attain, concerning which hope I am charged by the Judeans, or perhaps Jews would be appropriate in that passage. Therefore, we cannot imagine that the light brought to the nations was brought to any nations besides those nations of the fulfillment of the promises to Jacob recorded in the writings of Moses. So where in verse 23 of Acts chapter 26, Paul had said to both the people and the nations, in the context in which he had said it, he must have meant the Israelite people of Judea and the scattered nations of Israel, the tribes which formed new nations after the Assyrian captivity. The children of Israel, both in and before the time of the captivity, had been spread abroad in the isles and coastlands of the Mediterranean basin and the lands to the north in Europe, Mesopotamia, and Central Asia. Paul had brought the gospel of Christ to Europe and to no other place, while Peter is later found in Babylon, in Mesopotamia, as his first epistle attests in its closing verses. Here Jacob was told that his descendants would receive this light, and Paul, a bearer of that light, had attested that he labored on behalf of the 12 tribes of Israel, while attesting that he had acted according to the words of Moses and the prophets. In his epistle to the Romans, Paul had informed his readers in several different ways that they were of ancient Israel. And in Romans chapter 4, he attested that the promises to Abraham, that his seed would become many nations, was fulfilled as it is written, for which reason he was bringing the gospel to the Romans, as well as to others. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul was informing the people who were Dorian Greeks, people who were Dorian Greeks, that their fathers were baptized in the cloud and the sea with Moses. And also that certain of the surrounding nations were also Israel after the flesh, but that they too had been practicing paganism, the things that they sacrifice at the altar, they sacrifice to idols and not to God, is how he had worded it. In his second epistle to the Corinthians, Paul had described his ministry as one of reconciliation. Paul told the Galatians that they had been under the law, which was their tutor to bring them to Christ, in chapter 4 of his epistle to them. Throughout his epistles, Paul spoke concerning redemption, reconciliation, and other promises which had been made to the children of Israel in the words of the prophets and to no other people. Throughout this commentary on Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6, we have been compelled to make our citations from the New Testament text of the Christian. From the text of the Christogenean New Testament, so that it's not redundant, as the translations of nearly all of the passages cited here are quite poor in the King James Version and most other translations. The popular translations are subverted in many ways because the people who made them are blind as to the identity of true Israel in the world, in spite of the fact that Paul had identified them throughout his ministry. Now, continuing with verse 7, there is further substantiation for these assertions. Thus saith Yahweh, the Redeemer of Israel, and his, meaning Israel's, Holy One, to him whom man despises, to him whom the nation abhors, to a servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise. Princes also shall worship because of Yahweh that is faithful and the Holy One of Israel, and he shall choose thee. So Jacob Israel is the subject throughout that entire passage, the entire verse. In their time of punishment, Israel had been despised, abhorred, and made to become a servant of rulers. So this is another promise offering hope to Israel. Ostensibly, these rulers are the same which had been referenced in the commission of Paul of Tarsus. This we have already cited from Acts chapter 9, where Yahweh had told Hananias that Paul is a vessel chosen by me, who is to bear my name before both the nations and kings of the sons of Israel. There is no place in Scripture where Yahweh had promised redemption to any people other than Israel. And where we read that he shall choose thee, in reference to the assertion that he is their redeemer, he is still addressing the ancient people of Israel who had been scattered abroad in the consequences of their captivity. In order to cope with this predicament, the same denominational scholars who make poor translations of the words of Paul of Tarsus also redefine the meaning of the word Israel in the New Testament to describe the church, or anyone who may be persuaded to be baptized in the name of Christ and proclaim that I believe in Jesus. However, Paul had attested that his ministry was in accord with the words of both Moses and the prophets, and that his labors were for an Israel which consisted of 12 tribes, not of 12 churches, in Acts chapter 26. In Acts chapter 28, Paul has told certain Judeans who had rejected him that for this cause, therefore, I have called you to see you and to speak with you, because that for the hope of Israel, I am bound with this chain. The term Israel there must have described the same 12 tribes he had mentioned a short while earlier, just before he was sent to Rome in Acts chapter 26, where we read, and yes, I'm reading it again, and now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. God never promised the fathers niggers, ever. There's no promise of niggers in the Old Testament made to Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, or chinks, or spics, or people of any other race but Israel, unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews, or Judeans. All of this is resolved in Romans chapter 9, where Paul explained that they are not all Israel, which are of Israel. And he proceeded to recount the promises, while explaining that many in Israel were actually of Edom, vessels of destruction, rather than of Jacob, and vessels of mercy. That is why he also wrote in that chapter that he had prayed only for his kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites. So Israelites are according to the flesh, to whom the promises and the covenants, including the new covenant, as well as the adoption, the law, the service, and the glory, all belong. Paul's reference to the service in Romans 9:4 is another reference to the words here in Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6, where we read in the word addressing Israel, that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, the very 12 tribes for which Paul professed to have labored, and to whom James addressed in his only epistle. In either Old Testament or New, there is no other Israel but those 12 tribes. As we had seen in Acts chapter 26, the Jews wanted to kill Paul for bringing the gospel to the nations, in spite of the fact that they themselves had rejected the gospel. When Christians ever stop learning from Jews about the Bible and its history, only then may they finally find the truth. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 8. Thus saith Yahweh, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee. And I will preserve thee and give thee for a covenant of the people to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. I'm sorry. I'm tripping over myself. I'm actually trying to speak a little slower this evening because I only had 7,500 words to begin with, and I probably added 500 or 1,000 already in digressions. I'm sorry. Paul had also cited this verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, where we read, "We then, as workers, together with him, beseech you that ye," and this is the King James Version, you should be able to tell from the archaic language, "that ye receive not the grace of God in vain. For he saith, I have heard thee in a time accepted, and in the day of salvation have I succored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." So Paul of Tarsus identified this acceptable time here in Isaiah with the spread of the gospel of Christ. And here once again we see that the purpose of the acceptable time was for the benefit of the children of Israel in their captivity, that the earth would be established by them, and that they would inherit the desolate heritages. Here, much may be said in a long digression of Christian history. However, it is sufficient to state that as Christians, Europeans had built the greatest civilization known to history, and had come to rule over all of the races on the planet. However, today, in a supposedly post-Christian society, as the enemies of Christ like to call it, all of Christendom is in a state of decline as it is overrun with beasts. So now we can only hope to see the fulfillment of the promise of Isaiah chapters 59 and 60, which we have already cited, that when the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of Yahweh shall lift up a standard against him, and the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, saith Yahweh. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. I believe the Exodus from Egypt is actually a type for that, as darkness covered the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. But Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee, and the nations shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Mystery Babylon has not yet fallen, and Christians are now captives in their own nations. Therefore, the following passage apparently has a near vision fulfillment in Christ and a far vision fulfillment, which we may once again expect in our future, if we're fortunate to live that long as to see it. Perhaps our great-grandchildren will see it. We cannot know the day. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 9. "That thou may sayest to the prisoners, go forth. To them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pasture shall be in all high places. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. For he that has mercy on them shall lead them. Even by the springs of water he shall guide them. And I will make all my mountains a way, and my highway shall be exalted." Sort of like the making of the rough places smooth that we see in the prophecies concerning John the Baptist, who led the way for Christ. Now Christ is doing that same thing, leading the way for his people. While this certainly may have had temporal fulfillments, the words here are evoked in a later vision of the innumerable multitude which had gone through tribulation and had washed their garments in the blood of the Lamb, as it is described in Revelation chapter 7, from verse 15. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sits on the throne of God shall dwell among them. Here we have Christ leading them, or Yahweh God leading them. They shall hunger no more, just as we read here. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither thirst any more. Neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. Just as we see here in verse 10, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters. Just as we see here, even by springs of water shall he guide them. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. The children of Israel had the opportunity to emerge from darkness through the gospel of Christ, upon which they may stand in the light of truth. But just as significantly, they showed themselves by the gospel and glorified God when they accepted Christ, as Christ himself had said in John chapter 10, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." And this is the meaning of the words of Simeon in Luke, where he said that Christ was a light for the revelation of the nations and honor of Israel. By accepting Christ, the nations of Israel were revealed. Period. Luke chapter 2, John chapter 10, Isaiah 49, 9 to 11, and probably many other Old Testament prophecies. Verse 12. Behold, these shall come from afar, and lo, these from the north and from the west. And these from the land of Sinim. And I'm going to spend too much time on this word Sinim, so I apologize in advance. And I'm laughing because I could laugh at myself. I'm not some sort of psychopath. The reference to Sinim seems to be a plural form of the word sin, in the phrase wilderness of sin, as it appears in the books of Exodus and Numbers. However, that also seems to make no sense at all to refer to sin, the Hebrew term being related in meaning to the extra word Sinai, to refer to it in the plural. Neither Strong's original concordance nor the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew Lexicon define any of these terms. Although they list scholars, Brown Driver Briggs lists scholars who identify Sinim with China or with the place at the foot of the Hindu Kush Mountains, which they state is unlikely. They seem to lean towards the China thing. Jansenius defines sin as clay, and Sinai as perhaps clayey, miry, or clay-like. And in his definition of Sinim, he makes the appropriate remark that the context requires that this must be a very remote country to be sought for in either the eastern or southern extremities of the world. And with this, we would agree. But then he goes on to state that I understand this to be the land of the Serez, or Chinese, Sinenses, and I don't even know where he got that word from. I know what certain online resources say that it means, but we'll discuss that also. It doesn't mean what they say it means, or it meant it at a very late time and not in the original language. And he goes on to speculate that a Hebrew writer living in Babylon may have known these terms. However, Isaiah was a man of Judah writing in Jerusalem long before the Babylonian captivity. And this is the only place where Sinim is ever mentioned. If it does indicate China, that is fine because it is addressing the children of Israel who had been scattered abroad in captivity, where it says, "Behold, these shall come from afar." And that does not describe any Chinese people. While the land of Sinim is not the people of Sinim. In their dispersions, by the names of certain Scythians, the Sakae, the Massagetae, had dwelt east of the Caspian Sea, in the Oxus and Jaxartes river valleys. Today those rivers are called the Amu Darya and the Sir Darya. And in Bactria and in Sogdiana, which is described by the Greek historians Herodotus and Strabo of Cappadocia. The Greek word, ser, which usually appears in the plural form, seres, which Jasenius referred to in his definition of Sinim, described the people from whom silk was obtained. And in parentheses, they have, i.e., the Chinese. As Little and Scott define it from its usage by writers such as Strabo. But it was not necessarily an official word limited to describing what we now know as China or Chinese. Likewise, that word Jasenius used, sinensis, is said to be a Latin word for Chinese. However, it must be a very late word, since the classical Latin words for China and Chinese were adopted from Greek, as seres and sericus. Sericus would be of China, so that would mean Chinese. In any event, this entire discussion concerning Sinim may be moot. While the later Greek translators of the 2nd and 3rd centuries have Sinim here, the Septuagint has Land of the Persians. And the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible has Land of Syene. Although the editors note that the scroll known as 1Q Isaiah A has Sinim. Syene was the name of an ancient city in Egypt, where it would stand for south in this verse, if that is the true reading. In any event, just as the children of Israel had been scattered to the isles and coastlands of the west, many of them had instead migrated to lands in the east. However, Sinim is not necessarily China. In fact, the ancient Chinese endonyms, an exonym is a name that other people call you, like the Romans called Germany Germania. And we call the Germans. That's an exonym. It's a name from outside, naming something or somebody from outside. An endonym is a name from inside. It's a name that the people call themselves. So the Germans call themselves Deutsch, and they call Germany Deutschland. So that's an endonym. The ancient Chinese endonyms, which are the names by which the Chinese have historically called themselves, resemble none of these terms which we have found in scripture or in these definitions of Sinim. So Sinim is not a historical endonym for China, and it's not a historical exonym for China. The migrations of the Israelites, both east and west, are a subject of prophecy in Isaiah chapter 54. Originally, the captives of Israel were relocated in various places in and around the ancient Assyrian Empire in its more northern portions. And in that chapter, in Isaiah chapter 54, we read, "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the nations, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Now in reference to the gathering of Israel, described here in Isaiah chapter 49, there is a message of rejoicing. Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains. For Yahweh has comforted his people and will have mercy upon his afflicted. Yahweh shall have mercy on his afflicted, as we discuss in our commentary for Isaiah chapter 48. Yahweh had promised to refine them and choose them in the furnace of affliction. But in spite of that encouragement, or I should say of this encouragement, they are portrayed as having become despondent in verse 14. But Zion said, Yahweh has forsaken me, and my Lord has forgotten me. This also seems to indicate that the return, which is described in verse 12 here, is not necessarily, I should say, the return. These shall come from afar, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim, wherever the hell it's supposed to be. Okay. That it's not necessarily a physical return to Palestine, but rather it is a return to God, a reconciliation to Yahweh their God in the gospel of Christ, as professed by Paul of Tarsus, who had never told Christians that they should return to Palestine. Now Yahweh answers their despondency in verse 15 of Isaiah chapter 49. We're only going to make it through like verse 17, I think. Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have a compassion on the son of her womb? Yeah, they may forget, yet I will not forget thee. That's very explicit. We're only going to make it through verse 16 this evening. I just peeked. The academic historians, as well as the modern denominational commentators, usually pretend that the ancient Israelites either all died in captivity, which I've heard and read, or had disappeared by becoming mixed into the other races of Mesopotamia and the Levant, by which they are now assumed to be lost among the Arab races. They often ignore or even deny any connection to the historical Scythians, Sakae, and Cimmerians, and any observation of the historical migrations described in the classical histories or even in scripture. In later chapters of Isaiah, there are prophecies concerning those migrations, which were still future to Isaiah's time. Notably, in Isaiah chapter 66, where the word of Yahweh states quite clearly, and I will set a sign among them, speaking of the captives of the Assyrians, and I will send those that escape of them, meaning escape from the Assyrians, unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud that draw the bow, to Tubal and Javan, to the isles afar off that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the nations. Tarshish was in Iberia, which Paul had hoped to visit, as he had expressed in his epistle to the Romans. I believe that's in chapter 15. Pul was evidently a place in Assyria, but Lud is Lydia in western Anatolia. And the Etruscans of northern Italy were said to have been colonists of the Lydians in the classical histories and poets. Tubal was on the coast of the Black Sea in Anatolia, which Paul had also traversed on several occasions. And Javan was the Hebrew name for the Ionian Greeks, their most famous city having been Athens, ancient Athens, I should say. Certainly not modern Athens, has nothing to do with Ionians, with Javan. We may safely imagine that the isles afar off were the coastlands of Western Europe, predominantly settled in ancient times by Israelite Phoenicians, Dorians, and Greeks. I'm sorry, and Danans, the Danan Greeks, or one branch of the Danans. The Sardinians were another. And it's apparent that the Danans made it as far as Denmark. About 100 to 200, I should say 100 or 200 years, after Isaiah had written those words. That's also clumsy language. I should just state about 200 years, which is still accurate. After Isaiah had written those words, which we have just cited from chapter 66, no longer than 200 years is even more appropriate. After Isaiah had written those words, which we have just cited from chapter 66, they were fulfilled as tribes of a people whom the Greeks had called Galatahi, and the Romans Gauls, had begun to appear in all of those places. In that period of time, the Galatahi, who were originally also called Sakae and Scythians by the Greeks, as well as Cimmerians, who were a portion of the children of Israel and Assyria, had sacked Lydia. They sacked the Ionian cities of Western Anatolia, and they migrated into Europe as far west as Spain. One branch of them, whom the Roman historian Livy had then described as a strange new people, had sacked the cities of the Etruscans and then Rome itself around 390 BC. I should say no longer than 300 years after Isaiah had written these words, because when I wrote that this afternoon, I had the fall of Assyria on my mind. But the fall of Assyria is still 100 years off almost from Isaiah's time. So according to Isaiah, these certainly were the children of Israel escaped from Assyria, as we have already mentioned. Paul had told another branch of them, which later resettled in Anatolia, that the law had been their schoolmaster to bring them to Christ. Speaking to Galatahi, the Galatians were Galatahi. And he must have been referring to the laws of Moses. So the words of the prophet Isaiah, one of the very prophets whom Paul had cited, and with whom he had attested to have been in full accord, inform us that the captive children of Israel would be sent to those very same places to which Paul had later taken the gospel of Christ in the fulfillment of his ministry. The light promised to be sent to the nations of the children of Israel. Paul was working to fulfill prophecies such as this one in Isaiah, and he knew about it, and he professed it in his epistles. Verse 16, "Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me." The Septuagint has an odd reading of this verse, for which Brenton has, "Behold, I have painted thy hands, thy walls on my hands, and thou art continually before me." The Hexapla of Origen informs us that Theodotion has a word which means engraved, not painted. Likewise, the Old Latin found in that edition has supervallis delineave te, or I have drawn you on my palms. However, the verb delineare is to smudge or to draw a picture, according to our preferred Latin lexicon. So engraved may be inferred from that word. In the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, it is inscribed. Yahweh certainly did engrave the children of Israel upon the palms of his hands in the form of the scars left by the nails by which he was crucified on their behalf in the name of Yahshua Christ. I should say in the in his manifestation as Yahshua Christ is, or his incarnation as Yahshua Christ is more appropriate. That was how the light was brought to them in darkness. Thus we read in John chapter 20, but Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand on his side, into his side, I will not believe. Shortly thereafter, Thomas did see that. So he did believe, and he declared for Christ to be God, knowing that the Messiah would be Yahweh himself come as a man. The Greek word kir is a hand, as is the Hebrew word kaf, which appears here. It is not a forearm, as modern commentators also frequently assume that Christ was really crucified by his forearms. The gospel explicitly states that he was crucified with nails through his hands. Here we shall pause our commentary for Isaiah chapter 49. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening.